He hugged me hard and said, "Everything's gonna be okay." Thus began years of forced psychoanalysis with a parade of oddball therapists. My mom usually took art classes in the afternoons, so whatever unfortunate assistant my dad had at the time would drive me to my sessions after school. Lynn, Whitney, Dawn, Trish, and Suzanne come immediately to mind, but I'm sure there were more. Thanks, ladies. One after another, I resisted these counselors and their years of experience, their postgraduate training, their buddy-buddy approaches. Sure, I had issues, but I'd be damned if anyone could make me deal with them against my will. First, there was Barbara, who I remember as an older woman with a slight tremor who would wear mauve skirt suits with a wispy gray blonde bun. She would start the sessions by putting out paper and markers, and I would draw page after page of dark rain clouds and small boats in the middle of rough seas. Eventually, I got so tired of her frowny, "I know you're hurting" face, that I would just sit in sullen silence or yell nonsense at her until the clock struck 5. Sorry, Babs. Then we tried Stephanie, who had kids of her own and saw clients in her home. She was probably in her late 30s, had dark curly hair, wore jeans, went barefoot, and tried to be cool. She was into play therapy, so we cycled through weeks of board games and dollhouse scenarios. My favorite game was always Dungeons and Dragons. Nerd alert. One day, she brought out her batakas, basically lightweight, heavily padded baseball bats, and handed them to me, saying, "So you can get some of your anger out." I pretty much beat the shit out of her, as much as you can with a pillow and a stick, and she never suggested we play with batakas again. Then there was Carol, who was part tutor, part therapist. We were supposed to work on my homework together and just talk if we felt like it. I don't remember much about her, except she taught me how to make egg salad and showed me her mastectomy bra with a fake boob in it. I think I made her cry once. I eventually found a therapist I could connect with when I was about 15, Dr. Paul Hyman. I was dealing with the standard hostile and rebellious teenage issues, and it helped me to have a sympathetic adult I could be open with, who would then reassure my parents that I was generally okay. Paul was a classical guitar-playing, MD psychiatrist who looked like a cross between Anthony Bourdain and Lurch from the Addams Family. Psych 101 says I liked him because he reminded me of my dad and was a perfect recipient of my transference, but I think it was because he was smart, let me smoke cigarettes on his balcony, laughed at my jokes, and never tried to bullshit me. Okay, I guess he was a substitute dad in many ways, but he was a good one, and we were all grateful to him. Years later, in a 500-student Intro to Feminism lecture, the professor asked everyone who had been sexually abused to stand up. Women rose up all around me, looking around the room curiously. Some were crying, some were hugging, but all were standing tall, appearing proud to be counted as survivors. I did not stand, unsure if what had happened to me really counted as abuse or not. The professor went on to explain that 1 in 3 women has experienced some type of sexual abuse, and that she knew by looking that there were probably at least 50 more people in the auditorium, like me, who preferred not to be counted. It was in the discussion section for that class that I first entertained the idea that that asshole had done something to me that had nothing to do with my curiosity or invitation. He was a predator, and I was his prey. Nothing more. Sadly, this realization was validated the following year when I was called to the Ventura County Courthouse to give a deposition for a new case being brought against the same guy by a woman he had been dating who had a 12-year-old daughter. He had shown her the same books, given her the same articles, and done the same things. I felt horribly guilty that we hadn't gone to trial and possibly saved this other girl from being hurt, but I also felt relief. I don't think all the therapy in the world could have helped me understand the situation at the time, but once I did, I stopped blaming myself and admitted that I was not at all in control of the situation, even though I thought I had been. He was sick. I was a kid. It wasn't my fault. A swiftly tilting planet. Things began to change quickly in my dad's life as he prepped for Ghostbusters 2 and began to lay the foundation for spending the rest of his life with Erica. He bought a big, beautiful house in Santa Monica Canyon, which they decorated in what came to be their signature style of ethnic potpourri meets modern elegant comfort. Her old friends became his new friends, and his old friends all seemed very happy for him. I can feel my dad's disapproval as I write this, but I'm going to go ahead and say that this was the time in his life when he really started to embrace the materialism and luxury that his success afforded. In my child's mind, this was a departure I had a hard time accepting, but looking back, I understand that he was really just seeking greater comfort and ease in all areas of his life. He got a new car and wanted to get Erica one as well. She was driving a truly crappy 15-year-old brown Honda Civic at the time, but said she could not accept a car from him unless they were married. Soon after, he took me shopping with him to pick out her new car slash engagement present, and excitedly planned out exactly how he would propose. When the car arrived a couple weeks later, he put it in the garage with a big red bow on it, and after dinner, asked her to come outside to take a look at something. As soon as she saw the car, she knew what it meant and started crying. He got down on one knee and said, "Erica, I'm so in love with you. I've never been happier than I am with you. Will you marry me?" She said yes and fell into his arms, and I inched my way out of the garage and up to my room with a mixture of excitement, relief, and resignation. Then the wedding planning began, and with it, many trips to Beverly Hills, where they registered for fine china, silver, and crystal at Gump's. $200 for a spoon? I asked, incredulous. My mom's kitchen was filled with plastic plates from the 1970s and a toaster oven that she received as a wedding gift in 1967. Why do you need this stuff? These are special things for special occasions, they said, as if that explained anything. I couldn't wrap my mind around it, but was along for the ride and enjoyed looking at all the little tchotchkes and lovely things that seemed like they belonged in a museum, not in our living room. I was still shuttling back and forth between my mom's and dad's houses during this preteen period, and could never seem to get comfortable at either place as I struggled to synthesize all of the changes going on, deal with the aftermath of the situation with my abuser, and ride the waves of my own hormonal and developmental shifts. My mom vacillated between giving me almost total freedom and being relentlessly demanding of my time and energy. My dad and I started having little fights here and there, and with Erica in the mix, soon everything became a battle. I left my room a mess, argued belligerently about what I was and wasn't allowed to do, and honestly tried to make things as generally unpleasant for them as I could without being so awful that they would tell me to get lost. Erica and I still had great moments together. But things between us were becoming increasingly contentious, and I began digging psychological trenches for what was shaping up to be a long and drawn-out war, with my dad running interference between sides. As the reality of my dad's new life with Erica seemed to draw more sharply into focus with the upcoming wedding, my own identity and place in the family continued to blur. Ghostbusters 2, 1989. Written by Dan Aykroyd and Harold Ramis. Directed by Ivan Reitman. 5 years after saving New York City from supernatural destruction, the Ghostbusters, Bill Murray, Dan Aykroyd, Ernie Hudson, and Harold Ramis, have returned to battle a new spiritual villain, Viggo the Carpathian, a medieval tyrant who is preparing to make his own comeback by feeding on the negative energy of New York until he can take physical form in Dana Barrett's baby, Oscar. Peter. Let's suck in the guts, guys. We're the Ghostbusters. The film gets by on the sheer good-naturedness Reitman is able to place in all of his efforts, though it doesn't seem likely to inspire the same level of affection as the original. Innocence is one quality that can never quite be recaptured. Dave Kerr, Chicago Tribune. Jumbo budget and the same talent notwithstanding, the element of surprise is missing. And Ghostbusters, it seems, need that every bit as much as their targets. Mike Clark, USA Today. Here, the comedy breathes, and the illusion that it's not a factory-assembled product, which it most certainly is a nifty one. For a major studio blockbuster, the thing is darn chummy, and above all, that rare, modest thing, a good show. Hal Hinson, Washington Post. Ghostbusters 2 came out in 1989 when I was 12, and the circus of publicity and excitement started all over again. I was old enough by that point to have read several drafts of the script, and was happy that the Egon character got a little more love in the sequel than he had in the first film. As much as my dad was interested in my thoughts on the Ghostbusters 2 screenplay, I was really not his target audience, and I told him so. "I think you need a teenage boy to read this," I said. "I am a teenage boy, Violet," he chuckled. "Just tell me everything you think is funny, or if something doesn't make sense, or if you get bored, okay?" He watched me as I read, eagerly asking, "What? Where are you?" every time I laughed, looked up, moved, or breathed audibly. "Relax, Daddy. It's good. Funny. Scourge of Carpathia. Ha ha ha. Can I keep reading now?" He was trying to walk the fine line between making the sequel different and interesting enough to set it apart and maintaining the things that people loved about the original. As usual, my dad was most excited by the big ideas behind the film, and he was happy to be back together with Ivan and the rest of the cast. In the writing of the film, he wanted to tap into the idea of negative human energy accumulating in urban areas and basically coming back to bite people in the ass. I believe there is a shot in Ghostbusters 2 of a fur coat attacking its owner on Fifth Avenue, but my dad's initial fantasy for the film went even further. He told Brett Martin for GQ in 2009, "I wanted the Statue of Liberty to be inhabited by the evil spirit so that they'd have to destroy it. My image, how socialist is this, was that the Statue of Liberty ends up lying on Wall Street with her skirt up over her knees. A Marxist comedy." While it didn't end up being quite the political statement he envisioned, he was satisfied that the sequel remained true to the original and still had something more to say than the average action comedy. Artistic integrity aside, I was just happy that I got to meet Bobby Brown. Even though I had been around actors and famous people my whole life, I remember being so nervous to meet him on set. I can't, I told my dad. "Why not? You weren't nervous when you met James Taylor, right?" "Yeah, but Dad, Bobby Brown is cool." "Oh yeah, of course. Well, then just pretend he's like any other person you ever met, because he is." And he was. Pre-crack Bobby seemed like a regular, super good-looking, talented, and successful guy. He was sweet, but clearly more interested in his entourage than in the blushing, gushing 12-year-old daughter of Egon. He hugged me, posed for a quick photo, and then disappeared in a sea of tracksuits. On release, the movie was far less successful than the original Ghostbusters, and the reviews were mixed. Some critics called it lazy and mechanical, others said it was actually better than the original. There was another round of toys and merchandising, but a lot of kids seemed to have moved on to Batman, Ninja Turtles, Game Boys, and the new Sega Genesis by that point. The diehard fans of the original film still turned out, and in the end, everyone was happy enough, but the lightning bolt popularity that characterized the 1984 film just wasn't there. Harold and Erica, husband and wife. Harold and Erica got married on May 7th, 1989, at a beautiful property in Malibu overlooking the ocean. It was pretty much picture perfect. The happy couple shone brightly, clearly in love and ready to take the plunge. The interfaith ceremony covered all the bases of their respective spiritual and ethnic backgrounds. A rabbi, a Buddhist monk, and a Native American ceremonial drummer walk into a bar. But the drinks flowed freely and the mood was light. My Uncle Stephen was the best man, and I was the maid of honor. I wore a lacy pink dress with dyed-to-match low-heeled pumps as I stood near the huppah holding Erica's bouquet of calla lilies while they read their vows. There were probably 300 guests, including Erica's family and friends, my dad's whole family from Chicago, his college friends, industry people, and a few celebrities, Bill and Brian Murray, Sigourney Weaver, Robin Williams. But it wasn't a flashy, star-studded Us magazine centerfold by any means. In full late 80s yuppie glory, Dad and Erica worked their way through the crowd, schmoozing as guests nibbled Wolfgang Puckish pizzas, sushi, and tacos from little kiosks scattered around the great lawn. Later, a DJ played the Beatles, the Rolling Stones, funky soul oldies, and the obligatory hot, hot, hot while people got very loose on the dance floor. Meanwhile, I snuck champagne from behind the bar and ran around with the other teens, making an overly enthusiastic toast for the videographer and pretending that this was the happiest day of my life, too. My mom had been invited, then uninvited, as Dad and Erica worried that her presence might make people, including me and them, uncomfortable, and I dreaded going home to her when it was all over. She didn't say or do anything to make me feel guilty, but I did anyway. I knew how much she loved my dad and how hard it must have been for her to lose him again, in a way, as he committed his life to Erica in front of many of their mutual friends. I hadn't been particularly anxious leading up to the wedding, but looking back, I realized this is a protective strategy I still use to this day. Even in the face of major changes, or perhaps especially in the face of major changes, I do my best not to stress in advance. My dad's positive outlook and the privilege of my life have allowed me to assume that things will work out for the best. If for whatever reason they don't, you deal with it, but there's no point in making yourself crazy over something that may or may not happen. In this case, Dad and Erica were already so solidly together that I didn't think that much would change once they tied the knot. I was right. And wrong. My dad had stayed unhappily married to my mom for more than 15 years. Now it was clear that my dad was not only happy, but completely committed to a new life with Erica. I suppose that I had pushed aside my feelings of loss, abandonment, and displacement in order to be a good sport. But as the happy couple flew to Paris to officially kick off their new life together, I mourned the official end of my own honeymoon with Dad. Terrible tweens. My tween years were not particularly kind to me. For sixth grade, I went to Lincoln Middle School in Santa Monica and had one of the hardest and most confusing years of my life. I had been branded a slut in elementary school because I had big boobs, and yes, I was curious about sex. Back then, instead of hooking up, we called it scamming or getting together. And while I had scammed with a few boys, I had nowhere near as much sexual experience as everyone thought I had. It was like a self-fulfilling prophecy, because the more attention I got around my sexuality, negative or positive, the more I experimented with using that power. I started to drift away from many of the friends I'd made in elementary school, but found that all of the girls who didn't already know me hated me. Then someone started calling me the happy hooker, and it was like my fate was sealed. I got threatened daily and beat up semi-regularly by small groups of Latinas with carefully sculpted, gravity-defying bangs, who were mad that I had been talking to their boyfriends. If only they knew how much I envied their toughness and wanted to be like them. If only I had been more self-aware around the effects that being molested was having on my developing sexuality and self-esteem. If only the movement against slut-shaming had been active then, I might have felt empowered to say, "Hey, I'm just experimenting, and aren't we all? Give me some time to figure this shit out before you decide to hate me or not, but until then, how about a little love?" If only. Instead, I started going to the nurse's office every day to avoid lunch period and my afternoon classes. I faked fevers, stomach aches, and fainting spells, and even slammed my own arm in a door so I wouldn't have to face the girls who despised me or the boys who both wanted me and told me I was ugly, dirty, or nasty. I was too scared to use the bathroom at school, so I wouldn't go all day. Once, I couldn't hold it anymore and peed in my seat in class during last period. Thankfully, no one noticed. Sorry, janitor. And I just tied my jacket around my waist once everyone had left and ran to the car of whoever was picking me up to take me to my dad's. A few other times I would practically run the 5 blocks home to my mom's house, only to fumble with my keys and pee in my pants on the doorstep. Pathetic, right? I didn't talk to my parents about what was going on again because I figured I'd brought it on myself and didn't want them to know how bad it really was. Ultimately, someone told the guidance counselor that I had birth control pills in my backpack. It was, in fact, just my retainer case, but my parents were called in for a what-to-do-about-Violet meeting. Not the last, I'm sorry to say. The summer after sixth grade, while I was at camp, my mom, my dad, and Erica got together and decided to pull me out of Lincoln and send me to private school. I was furious. I had been miserable at Lincoln, but in my eyes, it was my problem, not theirs, and I wanted to deal with it in my own way. "You can't do this," I screamed. "Don't I have any say in my own life?" Most of the time, yes, but not on this one. My dad held firm. "We've spoken to an educational consultant, and I'll go with you to meet with her tomorrow." "I'm not going. You can't make me." "Violet, you told your mom that one of the girls you fought with had a razor blade hidden in her bangs. That's terrifying for us, and it can't feel very good for you either." "Well," I began, not wanting to admit he had a point, "it should still be my decision." Well, he said with a bite, beginning to lose his temper, it isn't, so get over it. This is so unfair, it's total bullshit, I'll never forgive you for this. I ranted as I ran upstairs and tore up a photo of my dad and me hugging on the beach in Carmel. I can now, grudgingly, concede that it was probably the right decision to take me out of Lincoln, but it felt awful at the time. The next day, the consultant laid out some options and we went home to discuss. Erica really pushed for Windward, a 7th through 12th grade independent school with about 250 students that was known at the time for being artsy. She had gone to high school there when there were only 50 students and felt it would be a good fit for me. There were other kids of actors and artists, and teachers were a mix of creative eccentrics and enthusiastic nerds. My mom was okay with this because she trusted my dad and was also at a loss about what to do with me. So we decided I would go to Windward, but it wasn't a cure-all by any means. There were a couple of boys who knew people from Lincoln, heard about my reputation, and teased me cruelly. Plus, I developed an inappropriate relationship with a young male teacher. No, the teacher and I did not have sex. There were a lot of long, late-night phone calls and some pretty amazing and intense letter writing, but the most that ever happened physically was one very awkward kiss. Eventually, I got bored and stopped taking his calls, and he took up with a classmate of mine, who told her parents what was going on, prompting them, understandably, to call the school and demand immediate action, ultimately resulting in his being fired. At Windward, without being scared for my safety, and in an environment where I didn't feel I had quite so much to prove, I had a little more psychic space to breathe and grow. This allowed me to re-engage with my education, push boundaries in more positive ways, and make some great friends, without whom I would not have survived the next 5 years. Even though Windward provided me with a better structure than I'd had before, I still rebelled in my own ways. It was around this time that I started smoking cigarettes, for real. When my dad and Erica smoked, I would sneak one here and there, mostly just to watch myself in the mirror. But once I started hanging out with the cool older kids at Windward, I started buying my own packs. My friends and I would spend hours in Burger King, Zucky's, or Fatburger just endlessly smoking our Camel Lights or Marlboro Reds, talking, laughing, and feeling like we would live forever. I tried to hide it for a while, even going so far as to blame my stinky, smoky clothing on the drama teacher, but no one was buying it, and I eventually just fessed up. My dad, who had started smoking as a young adolescent, didn't have much to say. Erica and my mother didn't like it, but they accepted it. I think they were just relieved to have me out of trouble at Lincoln, and this was the kind of trouble they could relate to, at least. In 1990, when I was 13, my brother Julian was born, which took some of the pressure off me at home, but also reinforced Erica's need for order and control. I loved babies, so I was happy to hang out and coochie-coo with him, and I didn't feel any kind of resentment or sibling rivalry. It all seemed to fit in with the new life my dad was creating, which to me may have looked like an endless episode of 30-something, but to him provided the stability and comfort he'd been seeking. My dad took some time off from movie making, and he, Erica, and baby Julian basically just stayed in bed cocooning for 2 years. At this point, I was going back and forth weekly between homes and still experiencing a kind of culture shock every Friday when I made the switch. My mom and I gave each other a pretty wide berth, but at my dad's, it felt like there was nowhere to hide. Dad may have been the man of the house, but it was Erica who ran the home, including everyone in it. She set the rules and expectations, and he backed her up. I don't mean to vilify her, really. We all have our issues, and I do believe that her need to control me came mostly from a genuine love and concern about my well-being. But I was the first kid she had to deal with, and I was no shrinking violet. I chafed under her ever-expanding list of rules. No Westwood, no Venice, no beach at night, and the worst, they had to talk to a parent before I could go to anyone's house. She assumed that everyone was on drugs all the time, was concerned about anyone who wouldn't make eye contact with her, and had very strong opinions on what was and wasn't appropriate, her favorite word. I had tried pot a few times by this point, but it wasn't a habit yet. Still, as soon as I walked in the door, she would be in my face with a knowing look in her eye. "Are you stoned?" she would ask. "Your eyes are red." "No," I would answer honestly, so paranoid about her invasive welcome home evaluation that I didn't dare give her anything to catch me with. "It's from my contacts." Something is going on with you, Violetti. I can always tell. Do we have to do this every time I come home? Well, if you would just communicate with me, then I wouldn't have to ask so many questions. Well, maybe if you stopped asking so many questions, I would communicate more. God! Classic teenage catch-22, right? My dad used to say, trust is something every teenager wants and something that no parent in their right mind can give. Still, he was never the one interrogating me. I don't deny that he was concerned about me or that there were reasons to be concerned, but he was just not a helicopter parent by nature, and if he'd been left to his own devices, I know we wouldn't have gone through anywhere near as many power struggles as we did. Years later, watching similar scenarios play out with my brothers, he acknowledged that he favored a more hands-off approach, but felt that he had to support Erica as the primary parent. Happy wife, happy life, I asked. He smiled wryly and said, that's the goal. Luckily, I had some close friends I could also go to for escape. One of these friends was Ethan. We met in 7th grade through a mutual friend and hit it off right away. He was a smart, funny, shy little skater boy who taught me about good hip-hop and didn't make me feel bad for being a busty, oversexed mess, and never let attraction get in the way of our friendship. There was a whole awesome group of guys like this, but I was closest to Ethan. In my mind, it was like Dorothy Parker in the Vicious Circle, but with pot, baggy pants, and baseball caps. Unfortunately, the only part that my dad and Erica seemed to see back then was the baggy pants and the tops of the baseball caps, as the boys avoided all contact, eye or otherwise, with my comparatively square parents. My dad would try to cajole them out of their resistance by saying dumb, funny things like, hey guys, nice pants. How many people can you fit in there? I'd be happy to recommend a good tailor if you're interested. Or once when I was playing music in the car as he drove a group of us somewhere. Did he just say, too short baby all in them guts? Nice. Great song. Really dopey, right guys? Dad, it's dope, not dopey, and you can stop. Stop what? He said cheerfully. I'm just talking to the guys about my friend Mr. Short. Dad, I said through gritted teeth while my friend snickered in the back seat. Oh, all right, Violet, I'll stop. But remember what Mr. Short said. Big butts, not big mouths, okay? And the boys died laughing while I pretended to die from embarrassment. What I was really thinking was, yes, why can't you just be a dork like this all the time? It was a nice change of pace from the dutiful husband and concerned father role he had taken on in his new life. My mom was always more than happy to provide a reprieve from the restrictions of my dad's house. She was cooler because she did her own thing and didn't insist that my friends talk to her. If my mom wasn't gardening, she was parked in the kitchen with her art supplies and her radio blasting opera or KPFK, largely oblivious to anything else going on in the house. I could do whatever I wanted in my room, and she was okay with it. My walls were covered with my friends' tags and graffiti, and there were overflowing ashtrays everywhere. It was this time where my two homes really could not have felt more different. I appreciated different things about each of them, but had a really hard time navigating the extremes. Why couldn't I have had the warm, nurturing environment and the freedom to do what I wanted? Why couldn't there have been some comfort and consistency to balance out the aesthetic and emotional envelope pushing? It was a lot to deal with, so I did what most teenage girls do. Focused on boys and friends and pretty much tried not to care about anything else. Groundhog Day, 1993. Written by Danny Rubin and Harold Ramis. Directed by Harold Ramis. Self-centered weatherman Phil Connors, Bill Murray, is on assignment in Punxsutawney covering the annual Groundhog Day festivities. When the town is hit by an unexpected blizzard, Phil finds himself caught in a metaphysical time warp that has him reliving the same day over and over again, and learning how to be a decent human being along the way. Phil. You want a prediction about the weather? You're asking the wrong Phil. I'll give you a winter prediction. It's gonna be cold, it's gonna be gray, and it's going to last you for the rest of your life. There were a lot of ways for this film to go stupid. It succumbs to none of them. Lewis Black, Austin Chronicle. For once, the audience isn't forced to surrender its intelligence or its healthy cynicism to embrace the film's sunny resolution. Hal Henson, Washington Post. Groundhog Day may not be the funniest collaboration between Bill Murray and director Harold Ramis, yet this gentle, small-scale effort is easily the most endearing film of both men's careers, a sweet and amusing surprise package. Kenneth Turin, Los Angeles Times. Groundhog Day is probably the most widely loved and respected film of my father's career. It makes every list of great movies and was embraced by religious and spiritual leaders of all stripes. He was so proud of and delighted by its reception by these communities. He told the AV Club in 1999, "People of every religion and spiritual discipline wrote me saying, 'This movie expresses the philosophy of yoga better than any movie ever, or the philosophy of Zen Buddhism.' Jesuits were writing me, rabbis were preaching sermons on the high holy days about it, psychoanalysts were saying the movie is about psychoanalysis, so everyone got it, you know? It's interesting that everyone tended to think they got it exclusively. The Buddhists would say, 'Well, no one else would understand it, but this is really a Buddhist movie. You must be one of us.'" Groundhog Day was the only film of my dad's to be recognized in any way by the film establishment, too. It won a British Academy Film Award for its screenplay. I was lucky to be able to read many drafts of the script, including Danny Rubin's original, which opened with the story already in motion, with Phil punching Ned Ryerson in the face, then explaining why it happened via voiceover. My dad initially loved how the story began in medias res, but then went back and changed it because he felt the more abrupt start would limit the audience's investment in the characters. Danny and my dad also went back and forth about explaining why the repetition was happening. Gypsy curse, glitch in the space-time continuum, but ultimately decided to leave it a mystery. Good choice, guys. Groundhog Day was filmed on location in the town of Woodstock, Illinois, which stood in for Punxsutawney, Pennsylvania. I was 14 during the production and visited the set with my friend Lauren for about a week. My dad joked at the time that the people of Woodstock were so happy to be featured in the film, he probably could have run for mayor and won if he'd wanted. In spring of 2016, the town's local movie theater, Classic Cinemas, hosted a three-day Harold Ramis Film Festival and showed many of his films in the Harold Ramis Auditorium. As has been widely documented, Groundhog Day was the film that broke the friendship between my dad and Bill Murray. Bill was going through a difficult time in his personal life, and he and my dad were not seeing eye to eye on the tone of the film. They had a few arguments on set, including one in which my dad uncharacteristically lost his temper, grabbed Bill by the collar, and shoved him up against a wall. Eventually, Bill just completely shut my dad out for the next 20-plus years. My dad did his best to be diplomatic about the whole thing and tried not to take it personally, but it bothered him. He described feeling variously heartbroken, confused, and yet unsurprised by the rejection, explaining, "Bill would give you his kidney if you needed it, but he wouldn't necessarily return your phone calls." Some people hypothesize that Bill may have been resentful of my dad's influence on his career or wondered if my dad had offended or betrayed Bill in some way, but truly, the root of his decision remains a mystery to this day. "I've had many dreams about him, that we're friends again," my dad said in the 2009 AV Club interview before he got sick. There was a great reunion feeling in those dreams. Bill was a strong man. John Belushi had that before, too. He was a rock for us. You'd do a movie with Bill, a big comedy in those early days, just knowing he could save the day no matter how bad the script was, that we'd find something through improvisation. That was our alliance, kind of, our big bond. I could help him be the best and most funny Bill Murray he could be, and I think he appreciated that then. I don't know where that went, but it's there on film. So whatever happens between us in the future, at least we have those expressions. Privately, he was only slightly less generous about the estrangement. "I've reached out, he won't respond. What can I do? Make myself crazy? Not worth it," he told me. I was more bothered on his behalf. "Curse him out. Send him a big box of shit. Something. He's a jerk, Daddy. What could you possibly have done to deserve 15 years of the silent treatment? It's fucking disrespectful and cruel." "I love your loyalty, my baby, but it's fine. I watched him turn on people before for virtually no reason, and maybe it was only a matter of time. Honestly, it still pisses me off, but what can I do? Make myself crazy? Not worth it. Bill, to his credit, eventually did come around toward the end of my dad's illness. In classic Bill fashion, he showed up at the house, unannounced, at 7 a.m. with a police escort and a dozen donuts. My dad wasn't able to talk much by that point, so they didn't get into the nitty-gritty of what had happened or go back and rehash any of the old stuff. But they spent a couple hours together, laughed a little, and made their peace. I've reached out to Bill a few times since my dad's death, but apart from one brief text message, haven't gotten a response. In my fantasy, he tells me he's sorry for shutting my dad and me out of his life and offers to be there for me in whatever way I need. In reality, I know this is an impossible ask, so I guess I'm stuck with my own unresolved feelings until he resolves them, or I die, whichever comes first. So you want to be a gangster. I went through several awkward stages in my teens. Hippie, goth, artsy, raver, gangster, girlfriend. Some of it was purely ornamental. Purple hair, a tattoo, combat boots and baby doll dresses, enormous baggy pants, Aquanet hairspray for days, and some very heavy lip liner. But other aspects of my rebellion and search for identity ran deeper. When I was 15, I was in love with the son of one of my teachers. Let's call him Oscar. I had a steady boyfriend at the time who was a wonderful guy, but I was inexorably drawn to Oscar. A bad boy light with a twinkle in his eye and a way with words. So I cheated on my boyfriend with Oscar, and we had a secret and exciting relationship that went on for a few months. Oscar was going through his own adolescent boy without a father stuff, and had recently been jumped into a gang. My friend Lauren and I would sneak out of my mom's house late at night and take cabs to Culver City to go to parties with Oscar and his friends. It was fun, and nothing really bad happened, but it could have easily gone another way. There was alcohol and guns and boys with big chips on their shoulders, and it all seemed a million miles away from my own privileged yet unsatisfying life. Our affair was destined to flame out, though, and one day Oscar stopped calling me back. About a week later, he was shot and critically injured by a rival gang. I was devastated and concerned for him, but also still so hurt by his rejection. My parents, understandably, flipped out. My mom had met Oscar a few times and knew I was head over heels for him. She may have been worried about the circumstances, but compassion was her primary response to the whole situation. I really appreciated her gentle and non-judgmental approach, especially since, as a result of the shooting, my boyfriend had found out about my cheating and all of his friends were angry with me and were very vocal about it. In a school of 200 people, there's really nowhere to hide when the tide turns against you. As was my unfortunate pattern, I took everyone's negativity and criticism in and turned it into fuel for my own anger towards others. Instead of being scared straight after the shooting, I grew increasingly more fascinated and infatuated with gang life in L.A. I guess I just had no idea who I was or wanted to be. I had all of this rage, but I didn't know why. I was privileged, but didn't feel it. It was like Little Orphan Annie in reverse. I had Daddy Warbucks, but I wanted the hard knock life. After several years of therapy, I think I understand it a little better. On an emotional level, I wasn't able to deal with my own feelings about my mother's depression, about my parents' divorce, about being molested. I was sad, but I didn't want to be vulnerable, so I got angry instead. But then there was nowhere to put the anger because my family was largely supportive and my issues just felt insignificant in the big picture. So I sought out people and situations that seemed to justify these feelings. Poor people had a right to be sad, and people of color had a right to be angry. I aligned with these groups in order to validate myself, and that somehow made sense in my adolescent mind. Not to mention that there was a cultural moment happening in music and film that celebrated, or at the very least romanticized, the strength and power of the bonds within these communities, along with the rage and hopelessness that so many were experiencing. I left Wynwood after ninth grade and went to Concord, an even smaller private school for kids who had been kicked out of or couldn't hack it in the more respectable private schools. The administration at Windward was tired of dealing with my behavior, cutting class, arguing with teachers, dressing provocatively, etc., and I had basically checked out of most of my coursework. At the time, Concord had about 60 students and was housed in an office building at Pico and Cloverfield. There were no extracurricular activities, unless you count smoking cigarettes in the parking lot, and the teachers were used to dealing with difficult kids. Still, the academics were rigorous, and the small class size meant that everyone got a lot of attention. It was there that I met Selena, not her real name, who was in the school on scholarship and had the life I thought I wanted. Looking back, it's embarrassing the way I fetishized her poverty, her toughness, her Mexicanness, even the recent death of her brother, who had been killed in a neighborhood shooting. But in spite of my awkwardness, we became close friends. She would do my hair, sprayed to the heavens, and makeup, thick black eyeliner, blood-red lips, long, curved, cherry-colored acrylic talons. And together we would go to the cemetery to put flowers on her brother's grave before we drove to Hollywood to cruise the boulevard, or to Alhambra, a neighborhood in East L.A., to meet boys. From the outside, we were in some pretty risky situations. Two 16-year-old girls driving all over Los Angeles in an unreliable car, alone in unfamiliar neighborhoods with guys we didn't know, our parents having no idea what we were doing. But everything turned out fine, miraculously. Selena had strict rules about what we could and couldn't do with these guys, and for whatever reasons, none of them ever pushed it. My parents weren't in love with my new best friend or my new look, but they didn't try to forbid me to see her. There was no phone at her apartment, and her mother didn't speak much English anyway, so I would bring my giant, cinder-block-sized cell phone with me, check in once, and then do whatever I wanted. Sadly, my friendship with Selena ended when she left the school unexpectedly in the middle of 10th grade. We kept in touch for a few weeks, but eventually stopped talking altogether. I don't know if she was tired of me, or if I was ready to move on, or if, without the commonality of school, there just wasn't enough holding us together, but I've thought of her often over the years, and I hope that life has been good to her. When I was 16, my reckless behavior caught up with me, and I got pregnant by a 21-year-old sleazeball. I can't even remember now where I met him or what I liked about him. Eddie, not his real name, was Italian, but looked Latino and affectionately called everyone the N-word. He was minimally employed, lived with his girlfriend and 1-year-old baby, and treated me like shit. I know, it's awful. Believe me, I'm cringing as I say this. We were together, in the loosest sense of the word, for about 4 months. I was working at the TCBY frozen yogurt shop on Montana Avenue at the time, and I knew something was wrong almost immediately when I almost puked into someone's hot fudge brownie sundae. I had been on birth control pills, but I wasn't great about taking them consistently. I had fantasized about being pregnant and having a baby since I was practically a baby myself, but this was not at all how I'd pictured it. I told my close friends right away, but wouldn't have been able to hide it anyway since I was throwing up all morning at school. They would leave class to go get me ginger ale and saltine crackers and covered for me with the teachers by saying that a stomach bug was going around. In a school of only 60 students, there was actually another girl at the school who, I found out through the grapevine, was pregnant at the same time. She and I were not friends, but we would smile weakly at each other on our way to lunch with our respective crews. I toyed with the idea of having the baby, but knew that Eddie was bad news and couldn't imagine having to deal with him for the rest of my life. I was planning to go to Planned Parenthood and take care of it without telling anyone, but I made the mistake of disclosing the situation to one of my brother's babysitters, and she threatened to out me if I didn't come clean. It wasn't that I was afraid or thought my parents would be mad. It was more that I was embarrassed, didn't want to deal with the fallout of their concern, and just wanted it all to go away with as little fuss as possible. The night before the babysitter's deadline, I gave myself a pep talk in the mirror. Just do it. What's the worst that can happen? They're not going to be mad. You got yourself into this shit, and now you have to go through them to get out of it. Just go, now. I walked into the living room where my dad and Erica were sitting watching TV. They both looked up at me expectantly as I leaned against the doorframe. I have to tell you something, I said, then froze and started crying. You're pregnant? My dad asked gently as he walked over to me and guided me back to the couch. I nodded through my tears and let him hold me while I sobbed. Everything is going to be okay, baby. We're going to take care of it, and we're going to take care of you. Before I could even say shmishmorshin, Erica was on the phone with my doctor scheduling the appointment. Both my mom and Erica had terminated pregnancies in the past, so there was no stigma, no shaming, and no question of what my choice would be. Dad drove me to the appointment a week later. I knew I was doing the right thing, but I still cried bitterly. It wasn't that I wanted to be a mom at 16, but there was a small, defiant part of me that thought, I could do it. This was also the first real, palpable consequence for my irresponsibility, and I felt like this poor, peanut-sized baby was paying the price for my carelessness. As I waited for the anesthesia to wear off, I hummed Sinead O'Connor's Three Babies and hoped I would get another chance to be a mom someday. After it was all over, I walked silently with my dad to his car and then sobbed into his shoulder as he drove. He made comforting sounds, patted my leg, and stopped to buy me a giant box of maxi pads on the way home. He expressed no judgment, even if he was feeling it, just comforted and reassured me. I vowed to myself that day that I would never be so irresponsible with birth control again. In many ways, this signaled the end of my teenage rebellion. If I wasn't actually going to be a teenage mom with a gangster boyfriend, what the fuck was I doing? I needed to find a way to accept myself and my life for what it actually was, while still staying true to the people and things I cared about. Pass the pipe. Long before he was giving Seth Rogen his fatherly pearls of wisdom and knocked up, my dad was giving me his bottom line advice about drugs. No powders, no pills. And for the most part, I listened. He often said that he felt like his most important role as a parent was to get me through high school without a disease or addiction. Given the pervasiveness of both of those things among adolescents and my unplanned pregnancy, it turns out this was a pretty solid goal. Because I had been exposed to so much as a kid, there was no way he could take a drugs are bad approach. Instead, he would tell me honestly, look, drugs make you feel really, really good the first time you do them. After that, you'll try to take more and more just to get that feeling back, but you never will. If you're lucky, you'll quit. If you don't quit, you'll probably die. You already know lots of my friends are dead because of drugs, and they were smart, talented, successful guys with their whole lives ahead of them, so just please be careful. Although he had quit all drugs when he got together with Erica as part of his new life, I'm glad to say that he never really lost his stoner sensibility. Without turning this into Cheech and Chong's Guide to Parenting, I will say that many of my favorite stories about my dad involve drugs. Once, in his early 20s, he and a friend bought a lid of grass and were driving around smoking joints. A police car pulled up behind them and flashed the lights, and Dad's friend told him to eat the weed so they wouldn't get caught. I'm not really sure how much a lid is, but I guess it was a lot, because he said he was stuffing his face with pot trying to get rid of it all. And when the cop approached the car, my dad smiled up at him with a mouthful of marijuana. Hello, officer, he said, with seeds and stems basically falling out of his mouth. He was beyond relieved that they didn't get arrested, but did not enjoy the crippling high that lasted for the next 2 days. Or there was the time in college, when he had a term paper due the next day, so he took a bunch of speed and stayed up all night filling the little blue composition books with what he thought was a brilliant essay, only to get an F and realize, when it was handed back, that it was completely illegible and made absolutely no sense. Or when he dropped 2 tabs of acid before a New York to L.A. flight in the 70s and was listening to classical music on the headset when suddenly there was all this turbulence and dinner trays went flying and stewardesses were falling down in the aisles, and he wasn't sure if it was real or part of the trip, so he just kept his headphones on and tried to go with it. One time when he was visiting Edra in the 70s, my dad had gotten high with some friends and gone to a movie with a walnut-sized ball of hash in his pocket. Halfway through the movie, police started walking up and down the aisles. Oh, shit, my dad thought. They can't be looking for me, can they? His friends were like, just be cool. But his heart was pounding in his chest. All of a sudden, the movie stopped and the house lights came on. Oh, God, he thought, I can't go to prison. There were always stories floating around their group about this or that guy who'd been caught with drugs and gone to jail in some very scary place. He was starting to sweat and feel woozy, so he ducked out of one of the exits, certain that the cops would be right behind him. "I can't go to prison, I can't go to prison, I can't go to prison," he repeated in his head as he tried to walk casually towards the cliffs, looking over his shoulder every other step. He got to the cliffs, took the hash out of his pocket, and threw it as hard as he could over the edge. "As soon as it left my hand, all my fear evaporated instantly," he said. "You idiot," I thought. "No one is after you." And then I thought, "I wonder if I could climb down this cliff." "Then what did you do, Daddy?" I asked. "Went looking to buy more hash, of course," he laughed. I joke now, but it seemed so real at the time, which is a great example of the fact that people on drugs do a lot of dumb shit. Oh well, live and learn. Even though it was not exactly his intention, this story, combined with gallons of Visine, always saved me from the unnecessary paranoia that seemed to afflict so many potheads. Good looking out, Dad. Part cautionary tales, part joyful reminiscences, these stories capture something important about my dad and his equanimity. He wasn't afraid to push the limits, but he always kept one foot firmly on familiar ground. In a 1983 interview with On TV, he said, "Drugs are really just a symbol of the expectation that you can have everything in life, that you can be totally euphoric all the time. Part of growing up is realizing there's no way you can feel great all the time. It just doesn't happen, and every high has a hangover that comes with it." When my dad and Erica got together, he was still smoking a lot of grass and doing cocaine semi-regularly, mostly at parties. She didn't do drugs and didn't think they were doing him any good. The way he told it, they were at a party together, people started cutting up lines, and Erica said, "I'm gonna do some." "Why?" he asked. "You don't like it, and it's not good for you." "Well, it's not good for you either, and if you're doing it, then so am I." "Okay, I won't either then," he said, and never did hard drugs for the rest of his life. That was that. I wasn't much of an adolescent drinker or partier, so we basically had a deal when I was in high school that as long as I kept my grades up, my parents wouldn't bother me about smoking weed. They were still suspicious of my behavior, though, as evidenced by the mayhem that broke out when I was 16 and stupidly took one of my grandmother's insulin syringes to play with. I know that sounds ridiculous, but I swear to God it's true. The cleaning lady found it and told my parents, and all hell broke loose. Suddenly, everyone thought I was a junkie, and I had to go for weekly drug tests. "I'm not gonna stop smoking," I told my dad. "We had a deal." "I know," he said, "and I know you want me to trust you, but I just can't. I love you too much, and it's too scary." So I would drive to my doctor's office every Monday and pee in a cup, and on Wednesday, I would get the report from my dad. "Okay, no opiates, but your THC levels were very high this week. Are you smoking right before you go in, or what?" "Sometimes," I replied casually, "but I got an A on my chemistry test." That was me, rebel with a conscience. I actually liked school at that point and got along well with my teachers at my new high school. They were used to dealing with all kinds of fucked up kids, and my issues were nothing new. My friends and I were largely motivated stoners, and despite being high pretty much all day throughout high school, we still graduated, went to college, and are largely functioning, productive adults. Go figure. One spring day during my senior year after 8 a.m. physics, Ethan and I had an hour break before our next class. We drove to get coffee, then came back to the school parking lot to smoke a joint. As we were pulling into the lot, Ethan said, "Isn't that your dad's car?" "No," I said, "I'm pretty sure he's out of town." So we smoked and were sitting in the car listening to music, probably Del the Funky Homo Sapien or Steel Pulse, and Ethan looked in the side view mirror. "Your dad is not out of town. He's walking towards the car right now." I jumped out of the car and a big cloud of smoke puffed out behind me. My dad hugged me, laughed, and said, "I can't believe you're getting high at 9 in the morning. I'm gonna go now. I dropped some papers off for you inside. I love you." As I got back in the car, blushing and beaming, Ethan asked if everything was okay. "Yeah," I said, "he's cool." "Then you should have asked him to join us. I want to get high with Harold." "Oh well, maybe some other time." Many years later, my dad and I finally did get stoned together. I thought it would be weird, but it was actually not at all. We smoked, we laughed, we talked big ideas, we snacked, we smoked some more. It was great. He and Seth Rogen had gotten high together after Knocked Up, and Seth, in his taped message for my dad's memorial, said that it was like a dream come true, and that my dad still owed him money for the weed. My younger half-brothers, not having experienced my dad's drug use firsthand, were kept in the dark about it throughout their childhoods and adolescence. When Tad Friend's article, Comedy First, came out in The New Yorker in 2004, the boys were 14 and 10, and I was given strict instructions not to discuss the article or show it to them. I guess the concern was that it would seem hypocritical to forbid them from doing drugs if Dad appeared to be celebrating his own drug use. Raised at opposite ends of the spectrum, total openness versus total secrecy, none of us have developed serious addictions or problems related to drugs, which is obviously the most important thing. But the second most important thing is that I got to get high with my dad, which was awesome. You go your way, I'll go mine. The birth of my brothers, Julian, in 1990 and Daniel in 1994, bookended the worst of my rebellious teen years. I was living with my dad at least part-time for most of Julian's childhood, but by the time Daniel came along, I was pretty much out of their house for good. It wasn't that they didn't want me. I didn't want to be there. Part of it was that I never really felt that I fit into their world and was tired of being the black sheep. Their lifestyle was so different from what I'd grown up with, and frankly, it made me uncomfortable. The vagabond caravan and eclectic assemblage of my early childhood had been replaced by luxury cars and Power Ranger parties, and even though I was no Cinderella by any means, I couldn't help but feel left behind by these changes. My dad also took on some interesting hobbies in his new life. He got interested in Robert Bly and the men's movement, and for a while he held a weekly group called the Roadkill Council of Men that met in the garage for African drumming, ritual craft making, and spiritual affirmation. I found it pretty hilarious and partly mortifying, but my dad took it very seriously, and every Wednesday, these very earnest, middle-aged, chino and sneaker-wearing white guys would chant and drum their hearts out amid the shelves of tools and extra toilet paper, and then come in after for lemon squares and Perrier. It still makes me laugh, actually, but if that's what it took to fulfill their primal urge to connect with each other, who am I to judge? After the mess I'd gone through with Eddie, I started thinking more seriously about my own primal urge to connect and what kind of relationship I might like to have. These questions were answered right around my 17th birthday when I met a great guy, Diego Jones, not his real name, and settled down with him for the next 5 years. When Diego and I got together, I moved back to my mom's house permanently, needing more privacy and fewer rules than were possible at Dad and Erica's. Soon after, Diego essentially moved in with us, although he kept a room at his parents' house. It was more of a shed in the backyard, really, which he used for band practice and beat making. Diego was a mix of crazy and super traditional, which is exactly what I needed at the time. He was romantic and sweet and creative and funny, but also liked to drink Colt 45 and get in fights. He was half black and half Mexican, played guitar in a heavy metal band, and knew every word to every Nat King Cole song. His parents, Dr. and Mrs. Jones, were both physicians who ran a clinic primarily for undocumented Latinos out of their home. Dr. Jones was an amazing and hard man who had lived an amazing and hard life. Diego was the youngest of 5 children, and they all adored their father, despite how cruel he could be with them. "Hey, asshole, how's that white Jewish bitch of yours?" Dr. Jones would call out from the clinic when we came in the house. That was on a good day. Mrs. Jones was the sweetest, most loving woman who once stuck a suppository up my ass after I had vomited for 12 hours straight from the flu. Needless to say, this was the moment when I really felt I had been accepted as part of the family. Diego and I spent a lot of time with his siblings and nephews, and he grew very close with my family, too. My mom loved Diego and enjoyed having him live with us. He got along with her in a way that I could not. He was endlessly patient as she showed him old movies, took him to art galleries, or held him captive in the kitchen listening to Ralph Nader on the radio. She didn't much care what we did as long as we kept her posted about where we were and when we'd be back. She even let Diego get a dog, bringing the household total of dogs to 4, a motley little crew of 2 Cocker Spaniels and 2 German Shepherds that would bark their heads off any time someone rang the doorbell. I imagine that many fathers would not be happy about their underage daughters being in any serious relationship, let alone one with a tattooed, non-college-attending rock musician of another race. But thankfully, in this case, my dad was not like many fathers. He saw that I was happy and didn't let the rough exterior prevent him from developing a warm and close relationship with Diego. Dad really took an interest in supporting his music and education, and they would make each other